Hello, this is Brian Cam, and you are listening to Clear Story, an audio experiment in which I read you texts that I'm interested in, both in prose and poetry, and then I just talk about whatever I'm thinking about those texts. If you listened last time, I was reading a section from Nietzsche's Human All Too Human and trying to connect that to 20th century philosophy of science, specifically that of Thomas Kuhn and Michael Polanyi, by the very unlikely route of A.C. Graham, a sinologist who studies ancient Chinese philosophy. And whether I was successful or not remains to be seen. I don't have a great idea of that. I think it may have been a little bit dense. So hopefully I will be a little bit more restricted in this episode. One direction that I'm quite interested in pursuing is the difference between the Chinese syncretic approach of just teaching everyone all of the classics. And of course, these classics are themselves pre-selected. They come from the 100 schools of thought period, so you can tell that there's a lot of competition going on, possibly much like ancient Athens was doing. But I wanted to contrast that with the Athenian system. I don't really want to say East versus West, because that is a very contentious place to go, and what does West mean, and things like that. But I think it's fair to say that the Athenian system was quite different. There were competing schools, what Thomas Kuhn calls the pre-paradigm schools, where they all kind of coexist. But what seems different to me, and I could be wrong about this, is that the Chinese classics were taught to everyone, whereas the Athenian schools were mutually exclusive. You could not easily move between them, and typically you would sign up your son, I guess it was mainly sons, to join some specific school, and he would end up a Pythagorean or an Epicurean or whatever it was. And maybe some of the schools, like maybe Epicurus' school, was a little bit looser about these things, but you weren't going to be both a Platonist and an Aristotelian, for example. That's my understanding, which is that each of these philosophical schools, as well as the Greek city-states individually, they kind of practiced their own arts. They were a little bit more exclusive. So I'm quite curious about whether that dynamic would lead to stability and under what circumstances. You could say that the Chinese system allows a kind of stability, but it's a comfort with contradictions. Whereas what becomes the West, let's be more specific and say Christendom, tends to go more for this repressive method of consolidating power and purging dissent. I don't have an answer to this, but what I'm wondering about is whether that latter model might tend more towards crisis or catastrophe. In Kuhn's terms, something like a scientific crisis, that you have a total overriding paradigm and dissent is never allowed. But when sufficient pressure builds up, the switch is sudden and severe. Whereas a system that allows contradictions within itself might not be so catastrophic, and it might in some sense remain entrenched in its old patterns because it has some kind of pressure valve for dissent. You can go and become a Taoist, for example. So in the Chinese system, you have Confucianism, Taoism, legalism, Moism, and you know, this kind of overriding concern with yin and yang, as well as with the Tao, the correct way of living, as well as with De, with virtue. So there are quite a few things going on there, but if you just are not that into the Confucians, you can kind of always become a Taoist. And I think these labels are reductive anyway. I don't think anyone strongly identified as one or the other. That's clear enough because even Zhuangzi or Laozi, the biggest names in Taoism, probably did not consider themselves Taoists because, yes, they were followers of the Way, but so was Confucius and so was Mencius and so was everyone else. There might not be as hard a line between these things as we would like to attribute to them. Now, I'm kind of tempted to contrast that with the progress of Christendom and its subsequent instantiation in the scientific worldview, but I'm going to resist that temptation and quell that desire and try to go to something completely different, and maybe even different enough that it may surprise you. Where I am going is a 2013 article on machine learning, and it is called The Stability Plasticity Dilemma. Now, before you get scared away, I am not one of these AI people, and I don't know enough about it to talk in any kind of technical detail. If you are one of these people and would like to correct me or supply me with a better understanding of this topic, I would really love that. So please do message me if I've got this completely wrong. But I read this paper over the weekend and found it really fascinating. The paper is called The Stability Plasticity Dilemma, Investigating the Continuum from Catastrophic Forgetting to Age-Limited Learning Effects. And it is written by Mermiod, Bugaiska, and Bonin. And they are in France. But this paper is written in English. So I'm going to read to you from a section called The Problem of Catastrophic Forgetting for Distributed Neural Networks. I'm going to omit the sections that include citations, the sort of parentheticals, but I will post a link to this paper in the show notes in case you are interested. Catastrophic forgetting is defined as a complete forgetting of previously learned information by a neural network exposed to new information. This problem is a general problem that exists in different types of neural networks, from standard backpropagation neural networks to unsupervised neural networks like self-organizing maps, or for connectionist models of sequence acquisition. Concerning artificial connectionist neural networks, such as, for instance, standard backpropagation networks, they are highly sensitive to catastrophic forgetting because of their highly distributed internal representations. Therefore, it is possible to reduce the problem of catastrophic forgetting by reducing the overlap among the internal representations stored in the neural network. For example, using larger systems, or, for example, sparse or interleaved learning. So what it's saying, as I understand it, is that if you have a network that is too flexible and it's learning, 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 sometimes new learning can cause the whole network to fail. And it does this by reconfiguring everything that you've previously done. But you've lost a lot of sensitivity to the old training data that you may have had previously. I'm going to continue and skip a little section. In order to prevent catastrophic forgetting, various researchers have suggested using a dual memory system, which fundamentally simulates the presence of a short-term and long-term memory. The principle is to consolidate information initially present in a short-term memory within a long-term memory in order to prevent catastrophic forgetting in connectionist systems. This principle, investigated within the perspective of neural computation in artificial systems, could also point the way to a more general principle that also applies to biological neural systems. And in these sections, this paper, as I think I said at the beginning, is from 2013, they are citing mostly papers from the 90s and early 2000s. So in that last section, I'm really fascinated by this. It reminds me of von Neumann's amazing book, or short book, or paper, I'm not quite sure what it is, which is called The Computer and the Brain. And it examines the trade-offs in cost and performance between short-term and long-term memory. If you know anything about computers, this is still an issue today, which is that you have RAM, or memory, which is very fast, but volatile, right? If you turn off the computer, it's gone. On the other hand, you have what used to be floppy disks or spinny disks, and now tend to be filled by SSDs. And these things are slower than the RAM. The SSDs may be very fast, but they're still slower than RAM. And they are cheaper per unit of storage, and they are non-volatile, or at least hopefully they're non-volatile. So this is also really interesting because if you think about human memory, it seems like we have this short-term memory. It is a little bit volatile in the sense that it can easily be overwritten. So let's say you're reading a book and you get a phone call, you're going to have to kind of do a little bit of work to get back in that zone once you have gotten out of it. Long-term memory is not really affected by that phone call that interrupts you, or at least hopefully it's not. And there may be this consolidation process Some people are pointing to sleep, and some, like Eric Hoel, are even pointing to dreams as a way of doing this that introduces random noise. And I will link to his paper about that if you're interested in the phenomenology of dreams and how it might relate to learning. So I'm going to go on a little bit in this paper and continue into the other end of the spectrum, what they call the entrenchment effect. So this section is subtitled The Entrenchment Effect, the opposite extreme of the plasticity stability dilemma. At the opposite extreme of the stability plasticity continuum lies the entrenchment effect, which may contribute to age-limited learning effects. In the cognitive sciences, this research field emerged as part of the attempt to determine whether items which are acquired early in life are better memorized in adults than those which are acquired later in life. Various studies working within this perspective have shown that words acquired early are processed faster and more accurately than words acquired later in life. These so-called age of acquisition effects have been found in a large variety of tasks, for example, picture naming tasks, as well as in different populations, for example, children and adults. And they go on to explain how these effects operate in neural networks. But I think this may be a more general principle. In fact, I think the authors of this paper think that it may be a more general principle. It may remind you of another paper written by Robin Carhart-Harris called The Entropic Brain. If you know me and have known me for a while, I've been talking about that paper for some time. So I think maybe 4 years ago I read it. I think it came out in 2014, and I've been slightly obsessed with it since then. And one reason is that Carhart-Harris has this theory that disorders like depression, and he also includes anxiety, as well as OCD, maybe even PTSD, are effects of overlearning. They are patterns that become too strong in the brain, and they become kind of attractors so that when you are trying to do something else, you get stuck in this rut or this deeper pattern that is kind of problematic. And it sounds quite a lot like that is what they are describing with the entrenchment effect. It even has the same descriptor, entrenchment, which I think Carhart-Harris compares it to a ski slope, where if you keep going down the same path, you're going to kind of carve this rut in the slope. So how does this relate to the Nietzsche point that I was making last time? Well, Nietzsche is saying that there's kind of two things going on in culture. One is that there's the strong type, which preserves the culture, and there's the weak type, which causes it to evolve. And you can see that there's kind of a fundamental trade-off between these two. If the society is not strong enough, and he thinks that a strong society and a degree of consensus, you might remember that from the beginning of that passage on ennoblement through degeneration. He says that it's important to have this strong culture and to have things that are undiscussable, things that are just baked into the system. At the same time, it's important to have people who dissent or refuse to conform from that if the society is not to fall into stability, which leads to stupidity. I think he says that stupidity haunts all such stability like its shadow or something like that. Now, you may hear a similar thing going on in this machine learning paper, which is that if the system is too chaotic, or if you let the chaotic parts of the system touch the long-term memory, that can be a problem for a neural network. If you just have too small of a network, it's a little bit too random, it's a little too responsive, then it can lead to catastrophic forgetting. Now, this seems really interesting to me because you can think of examples in history where there was an attempt to rewrite all of history. You might think of the French Revolution, or maybe the Reformation, or possibly certain 20th century revolutions, where there's this idea that if it belongs to the past, it's therefore stupid and we don't need it, and we're going to get rid of it. And some of those things were quite catastrophic. I'm not going to go into a description of those. I know there are many historical viewpoints about the dynamics behind those, whether they were a good thing or a bad thing, but I'm just going to say that you probably can think of examples where the cutting edge was allowed to touch the long-term memory of a culture. And when the cutting edge gets in there, it does some excising, and it may go a little too far. I think that's a not too controversial way to put it. On the other hand, you can think of societies that are so stable that they've failed to adapt to new conditions, what Nietzsche would call stupidity through stability. And it seems to me that this is analogous to what the machine learning people are calling the entrenchment effect. So what you might say is that there's a spectrum between explorer mode and exploit mode. And on one side lies catastrophic forgetting. That may not just be a feature of neural networks. It might also be a feature of human culture. On the other end of the spectrum, on the exploit side, where you found a successful strategy and maybe it's not working as well as it used to, but you for some reason just keep doubling down. And that leads to what they're calling the entrenchment effect. And so again, entrenchment effect, it may not just be artificial neural networks. It might also be in single human minds, and it may also be a thing at the cultural level. I would eventually like to suggest it may also be operating at the species level, or at the clade level, or at the phylogenetic level. That's a much bigger argument, and I promise to keep this one relatively short. So I just want to suggest that this same kind of balancing act arises, in my view, in many different areas. Just in the last two times, we've gone through ancient Chinese philosophy, we've gone through continental European philosophy in the 19th century, we've gone through philosophy of science in the 50s and 60s and 70s through Michael Polanyi and Thomas Kuhn, and we've gone through machine learning. Now, this may not be the most diverse set of inputs yet, but I want to suggest that this pattern keeps cropping up in other places as well, that there's a kind of balancing act. There's a critical threshold. You might think of Scylla and Charybdis from the Odyssey. There's the Scylla of entrenchment and the Charybdis of catastrophic forgetting. I don't know if that makes sense, but it sounds good, doesn't it? So yeah, I'm gonna leave it there and I'm gonna read you a poem. And in keeping with last week, I am going to do another Shakespeare sonnet. This one, like actually several of the sonnets, is about memory. I chose this one in part because there is a question of brain and heart. And I have not really mentioned that, but in Chinese philosophy, the seat of cognition and character and everything else is not up in your head. It is in your heart. So you can decide whether you think this one is related to what I've just talked about or not. Sonnet 122. Thy gift, thy tables are within my brain, full charactered with lasting memory, which shall above that idle rank remain, beyond all date, even to eternity. Or at the least, so long as brain and heart have faculty by nature to subsist, till each to raised oblivion yield his part, of thee thy record never can be missed, that poor retention could not so much hold, nor need I tallies thy dear love to score. Therefore to give them from me I was bold, to trust those tables that receive thee more, to keep an adjunct to remember thee, were to import forgetfulness in me. And apparently people think this is about a lost notebook. In any case, I am Brian Cam. Thank you for listening again and tolerating my random discursions. I hope you enjoyed it. I would love to hear from you. You can reach me at Brian Cam, BryanKam. That's M for Mike. Or you can also leave me a message at anchor.fm/BKAM. Bravo Kilo Alpha Mike. I will be away from London for a while, so whether or not I continue the podcast during that time over the next month remains to be seen. I may try to do it on my phone at some point, and you may have to tolerate a slightly worse audio quality. But we shall see. Thanks again.